The Bob Murphy Show, episode 58.
There's a tidal wave coming. What you gonna do?
Get ready for another episode of The Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. It's your source for commentary and interviews conducted by a Christian and economist. Now here's your host, Bob Murphy.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of The Bob Murphy Show. This is going to be an unusual one for you guys. What I'm going to do in this episode is try to really get you to believe me when I assure you that if you are an anarcho-capitalist, right, if you're a believer in the full privatization of all government services, including military protection, that that's not a suicide pact. As I explained in episode 46 of the Bob Murphy Show, where I replayed a lecture I gave at Mises University this summer, this is 2019 that I'm talking to you, the free society can mount a much more effective military defense than the statist society. For some reason, even many ANCAPs think that, oh yeah, the free market's great. The government is either incompetent and or handcuffed by various institutional limits on its responsiveness and its ability to be creative, to tap on the knowledge contained in everybody in society. We can see that, and that's why, oh, the state trying to monopolize food production, that's just, you're asking for trouble. You're going to get mass starvation is what you're going to get there. If you wanted to have a vibrant computer industry, what would you do? Would you have the state in charge of that, or would you have private companies in competition making all the computers? So likewise, if something's really important, like defending your people from outside military attack, what do you want to have in charge of that operation, that defense? Do you want to say to the politicians, here, you guys handle this? Or do you want to say to private enterprise, you guys handle this? Right, and so that I was walking through the logistics, the mechanics of it in that Mises University lecture, very briefly, just to recapitulate, the argument I made is that it would probably be large insurance companies that would be the direct funders of military defense. So just imagine something like Manhattan with all these skyscrapers and just hundreds of billions of dollars easily in wealth sitting there concentrated in a very small geographical area. If there's a big fire, that could cause a lot of damage. And so the owners of these large buildings have fire insurance. And part of what happens in those contracts is you have to have sprinklers installed and contracts, you know, negotiations or arrangements with the fire department. You have smoke alarms and evacuation drills and so forth. Okay. And even if a lot of that stuff is because of government building codes, you can imagine in a totally free society, the fire insurance company would insist that, yeah, if you're going to build a huge skyscraper, don't make it a burning death trap in case somebody, you know, puts his cigarette and flicks it in the garbage can. You don't want to have a 50-story blaze. All right. And so you would build the building accordingly. And if nothing else, again, the fire insurance company would make sure before we issue a policy on this building, it's got to be built according to these specifications. All right. So you don't need a monopoly state to ensure that people don't build death traps. Now, if that makes sense to you and you say, okay, yeah, by the same token, if you have a building that's worth billions of dollars and a foreign state can just send in bombers or send in infantry to seize control of it, well, that's kind of a bummer. And so there could be insurance contracts indemnifying you in the case of battle damage or military invasion, loss of property through that channel. And finally, the insurance companies that are issuing such contracts, just like they could see, oh, if we insist on having smoke alarms installed and fire extinguishers placed at strategic locations and having arrangements made and, you know, either funding a fire department or we separately just provide the payment for that, or we give a bonus or, you know, a reduction in premium for a client that has arrangements made with a fire department company. Likewise here, the insurance company's not just going to sit there and say, well, I really hope nobody ever bombs us, because that would be expensive if we had to identify our clients from that. No, they would realize we can spend money to make it much less likely that these bad things that we're now on the hook for contractually happen. And so rather than just sitting back and hoping nobody bombs us, we could spend some money to install surface-to-air missile installations. Or we could pay some money to an outside company that maintains a small fleet of fighter jets and has cruise missiles that, you know, we can repel an incoming bomber attack. And we have satellites up in space, and we have a company, or we have a contract with a company that provides intelligence so we can see if some foreign army is massing on our border, so we're not caught flat-footed. All right, so that's the basic framework. And then I'm not going to go through the whole argument again here, but I was saying how economic calculation is critical in something like modern warfare, even though you wouldn't think so at first. You'd think, oh, no, that has nothing to do with the voluntary market economy. This is war. Well, yeah, but even there, especially in modern war, when major nation states go to war against each other in a process that takes years sometimes, there, a lot of it has to do with logistics, and it has to do with which side has the better strategy and doesn't make completely boneheaded mistakes. And this is the crucial part, can adapt to the situation more quickly, right? So that they don't just keep making the same boneheaded mistake for 18 months in a row before finally they start doing something else. That's really the thing that puts you on top. And so for all those reasons, I'm arguing that other things equal, if you have a certain region that is inhabited by a genuinely free population, so it's a free society in the sense that somebody like Murray Rothbard would have meant the term, they are going to be able to easily repel an invasion from neighbors who are anywhere close to their level in terms of population, wealth, technology, and so on. And it's hard to know, you know, what to hold equal in these comparisons, because the idea is, if you had people who originally were about the same, so let's say like, let's say the state of Texas right now in current modern day the United States, if all of a sudden the Texans just went full ANCAP because they read a bunch of my essays and they're listening to Dave Smith, let's say, you could say at first, oh yeah, they have the same technology as the rest of the United States, but they wouldn't for long. They would zoom way ahead of them. And you could say in the beginning, oh yeah, there's a comparable standard of living, but not for long. They would zoom way ahead. So am I claiming a small group of Rothbardians are invulnerable? Well, no, of course not. If some small group of people outside Nazi Germany in the late 1930s read Rothbard and 16 guys said, ha ha, we're in Capistan, take that, Adolf, they would get rolled right over. But so did the French. Okay, so again, it's funny that I have to make this point, but I do. A lot of people point to the strength of Nazi Germany and say, a hypothetical little ANCAP society wouldn't be able to have repelled Nazi Germany when it was at its prime. So therefore, private defense doesn't work. Okay, well, by the same token, every state that the Nazis conquered shows, apparently, that government-sponsored military defense doesn't work, right? And in the case of France, for example, it's crystal clear to me that one of their mistakes was they put all their eggs in one basket with the Maginot Line. And that's exactly the kind of thing that wouldn't happen under a decentralized defense effort, where you'd have various companies trying different things. So it's funny that a lot of what the alleged strength is or virtue of state-provided military defense, actually, you see in some situations, is its weakness or its downfall. Right, people often talk about how, oh yeah, it's fine to have decentralized markets when it comes to consumer goods and things like that. But when there's a war on, you got to have the government just take control and make sure that it rations the resources to where they need to go. I mean, you can't have things being used to make radios for consumers when we got to have that equipment going into making fighter jets and transmission boxes for the naval warships. And so that idea that you need to have some central intelligence in charge of the whole economy when there's a war on, because that's important. Gosh darn it. Well, again, that's not true in general. Why would it happen to be true with this particular application? In general, like if you're really concerned about food production, the best way to maximize total food output and to make sure the types of food that are produced are the ones that your people enjoy, it's a decentralized market. So what I want to do in this episode is illustrate all of these themes by taking some samples from Dan Carlin's Hardcore History podcast series that he devoted to World War I. So if you don't know who this guy is, name's Dan Carlin. He's got a very popular podcast called Hardcore History, and I highly recommend it. It's phenomenal. And he's got a series that's free. So some of his series, like, you have to pay for. And I think he might have like a rolling wall in terms of when he releases new stuff. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at it recently. But he has different ways of earning money for his work. But I think like his flagship free sample, as it were, to show everybody how awesome this podcast is, it's called Blueprint for Armageddon. And it's a multi-part series covering many, many hours of his commentary, just going through the history of World War I. And if you haven't heard of him, or you haven't, maybe you've heard of him and haven't given him a shot, I mean, that's partly what this episode right now that you're listening to is going to do for you, is you're going to realize, oh, wow, this is great. I mean, once you start listening to the guy, you realize why it's got such a huge following. So what I thought I would do is, because in the spirit or in the mindset that I had, thinking along these lines about private military defense, then independently, because my son was interested in it, we were playing Axis and Allies or something, and I started just playing for him Dan Carlin's. We had to go on a road trip too. And so I said, oh, let's listen to this Dan Carlin's podcast on World War I. It's great. And so it was the second time I was listening through it, and I just started jotting down notes. Like, oh, this is exactly the kind of thing I'm talking about. So what I'm not going to do here, I just don't have it at my fingertips, and it's a pretty quick point. But the kind of thing he's getting at, just example after example of how incompetent the major powers are, right? So we're not just talking about some terrible army. We're talking about even what the Germans did, or even what the British did, or even the French, right? So that's the kind of thing we mean here, that the preeminent powers, the ones that you would think, oh yeah, I mean, a free society along Rothbardian lines, they might have really fast computers, and I'm sure they would have the coolest looking cars, and they'd have more pizza. But I mean, come on, let's face it. If it were back in 1914 and there was some ANCAP country sitting in Europe, they'd be sitting ducks for the mighty power of the state marching against them. And I'm saying, no, that's wrong. And I want you to stop being so afraid, that if that's what's holding you back from having a full-throated defense of anarcho-capitalism, is you think that, oh yeah, I mean, push came to shove, we'd get wiped out by these huge standing armies that the states would throw at us. No, you're wrong. That's, you're not fully appreciating, number one, how powerful a free society really is, and number two, how incompetent the armed forces of major states are. The reason they don't seem incompetent is they fight each other. So it's like, yeah, if these incompetent, bumbling forces battle each other, then the fact that they're incompetent doesn't necessarily spell their downfall, because it's, you know, which one, it's like that line about chess, the winner of chess is he who makes the next to last mistake. So there's that element. And of course, they prohibit competition from the private sector domestically. So, you know, we don't have something to compare them to. It's not that you can look, I mean, the way you can like compare the post office to FedEx or UPS or something, there's, you can't do that when it comes to fighter jets or cruise missiles, right? Even though those are technically private companies under working with government contracts, it's not like you can look at an analog, really. So that's why they seem so intimidating. But if somebody just suggests the hypothesis that, hey, modern nation states, particularly when it comes to total war, when the civilians just give them a blank check and do whatever you want, and you get to see the state in its, quote, full glory, you can see just how ludicrous it is. Besides being immoral, just how incompetent at achieving even these standard war objectives. Now, before I go into this, let me just explain my bigger project here. So as I'm sure most of you know at this point, unless this is the first time you've heard me, I am actually a pacifist. And so that, I mean, that you libertarianism per se does not entail pacifism, clearly, right? The non-aggression principle just says you're not allowed to initiate aggression, or it would be immoral if you did so. It doesn't say it's immoral to use violence defensively, but I personally am a pacifist. So I'm a libertarian who is also a pacifist. And I debated Tom Woods on that topic. And if you're curious about that, Tom and I will have that in our supporting listeners groups. There's a way you can see that debate. So what I'm doing here, because I want to just clarify exactly what I'm doing. It might sound like I say, oh, look at this. Bob's saying how cool it is if an ANCAP society formed and then, and they'd have all these cool weapons and they'd go to war and come on, what's up? What's up, states? Come on, we got you. What's up? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying if they were using defensive violence, they would easily be able to repel any invasion. But I'm saying actually there'd be a better way still. Okay, and I'll defer that discussion for a further episode down the road here. But notice, in case those of you who agree with my pacifistic views, in case you think I'm being inconsistent, notice what I'm doing here is I am telling people who think, yeah, I really like the idea of a free society, but you know, we would be sitting ducks for a state. And so that's why I hold my nose and I'm kind of a minarchist, because, you know, I really just don't see how that could be feasible or viable for us to live without taxation to at least fund the military and maybe the police. So there, that type of person with that mentality is advocating violence, right? That person is actually not full-throatedly in support of the non-aggression principle, because that person thinks, yeah, you need a limited state, which entails taxation, which means technically people are having money taken from them against their will institutionally to fund this thing that we give a monopoly on lawful use of violence to. And so, no, that's, if you're a pacifist, you should not be for taking money away from people under the threat of violence in order to build a standing army, in order to build a nuclear arsenal, to have a deterrent capability against other states and so forth. All right. So there's nothing inconsistent here that I'm doing. I'm not saying violence is cool. I'm actually saying to you minarchists out there, stop worrying so much. No, you don't need to advocate violence, even in that little speck that you have left in your worldview, because you think, oh, if we didn't have violence against the taxpayers, the citizens of our country, or the threat of violence and imprisonment, then we'd get wiped out. And I'm saying, no, you wouldn't. All right. So it's a baby step here. I'm just showing you, you do not need to support a state because you think without it, we would get conquered by a foreign military. That's what I'm doing in there. And if I succeed in getting you to see that, I've actually reduced the scope of what's acceptable violence in your book. So I'm still advocating or working towards a pacifist society. It's just I'm going one step at a time, right? Instead of going right for the whole thing at once, I'm saying let's work it slowly. And that was my own progression as well. So that's why I'm doing it this way. It's a harder sell to go for the whole thing at once. So let's take baby steps. Let me show you, you do not need to threaten all of your neighbors implicitly with violence by saying, come on, we all got to chip in to fund the defense effort. Otherwise, we're sitting ducks. No, you don't need to do that. Just sit back, let voluntary market contracts run the show, as it were, or facilitate things, and everything would be fine. That's what I'm arguing here. Or not that everything would be fine in the sense that I'm guaranteeing nothing bad would happen, but you would be in a much more defensible position than if you had a so-called limited government, among other things, because your government would not stay limited, right? So if you don't want to be conquered by a hostile force of gun-toting men, the last thing in the world you would do is institute a state, because that's exactly what you're going to get, that you would have conquered yourself from within. Okay. So now that I've clarified the framework here and what we're doing in this episode, let me mention two examples that Carlin brings up. He pointed out that, so the war starts in summer of 1914, and then he says at some point that it was not until the end of 1915 that the major powers were finally systematically equipping their troops with steel helmets, that up through that point, a lot of the troops were still getting outfitted with felt hats. So, I mean, in general, that's nuts, but especially in World War One, which is the war of trench warfare, where guys are sitting for months on the front lines, you know, just dug in with artillery blown up all around them. The idea that they're sitting there without even steel helmets on is crazy. And just showing you, and it's not because the armies weren't cranking out all sorts of equipment and, you know, producing things, right? It's not because the governments were like, oh, we'll be willing to spend 0.1% of GDP on the war effort. And gosh, sorry, those steel helmets are too expensive. No, that's not why. It's because they're just, maybe not incompetent is not the right word, because again, as longtime listeners know, I often chastise people for thinking the government's bumbling and stupid when really it's just showing public choice incentives. So the government, Uncle Sam, is not dumb because he funds, gives tobacco subsidies on the one hand and funds anti-smoking commercials on the other. You might say, oh, that idiot Uncle Sam's contradicting himself. And no, there's nothing stupid about it. The stupid thing is assuming the politicians want kids to stop smoking and that's why they're funding those commercials. That's the dumb thing. All right. So in this episode, when I'm talking about bumbling and incompetent, I'm just using that as shorthand. And maybe in subsequent episodes, I can elaborate on that and actually be a little bit more precise. So, I mean, part of what's going on here is the people making these high-level decisions, they have no feedback. They don't care, really. They don't get penalized in any official sense if 30,000 people die under their command. Okay, I'm not saying they're completely indifferent, but part of what's going on is they're not being made to feel that pain. And again, this is another reason that a market-based defense effort would be far superior, that you don't want the people making these military decisions to think they have millions of men of cannon fodder at their disposal that are, quote, free. So this idea that, oh, the military draft, say what you will about its morality, but it allows the authorities to defend the country at lower cost, it allows the authorities to defend the country at a lower explicit expenditure price, but the cost is still there, right? That labor could have gone into other lines. Again, so I'm not just making a humanistic plea. I'm saying even just being cold-blooded raw efficiency and saying we've got these resources at our disposal, what's the best way to combine them in order to repel this alien invader, to send infantry to the front lines wearing felt caps when there's shrapnel blown up all over. I mean, that's just insane. And yet that's what they were doing for a year and a half. All right, so that's one example. He also told this story about how the Russians, I don't know how long this persisted, if this was like just true in the beginning and then the Russians fully mobilized, or I don't remember the exact details, but Carlin says at least for this one major battle that the Russians were involved in, that they would take they would pair off the infantry, the Russian troops. And so each person would have like a buddy. And the reason was that the two of them would just be issued one rifle. So they'd give the rifle to one guy. And then the other guy's job, his orders, were just to shadow the first guy around. And then if and when the first guy gets killed, then you pick up his rifle and now you're armed and now you can go fight the enemy. Okay, so just showing again how poorly equipped they were and how stupid that was. Because as an economist, this is so obvious, but let me just spell this out. You might be tempted to say, well, yeah, sure, Bob. I'm sure they would have loved to have extra steel helmets, and I'm sure the Russians would have loved if someone just gave them a gift of a bunch of rifles, but they didn't have it. You know, you go to war with what you got. And no, it's not just a fact of nature, what you're equipped with, how you deploy your resources affects what you have. And so rather than sending as many troops as they did to the front lines wearing felt hats, instead they could have sent 10,000 fewer troops and kept the other 10,000 home on the home front working in industry, creating, among other things, a bunch of steel helmets. And I imagine, given the proportions and the trade-offs involved, blah, 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 that actually would have made more sense. Right, so given the existing war plans of the various powers, they could just make that little tweak and kept a few of the infantry back home so that the remaining infantry going into battle, yes, you'd have fewer soldiers, but now they'd all be wearing steel helmets rather than felt hats. So that's an example of what I mean. Or on the Russian side, again, send fewer troops and have the rest of them stay home. And it doesn't mean they actually need to make rifles. They could make other stuff that maybe it's cheaper for them to trade it for rifles with some other power. You know, again, I don't know exactly what the situation was they're facing, but you see the point. All right. That's just two examples showing just how incredibly ill-equipped they were. You could say, well, the Russians, you know, they're backward, but the stuff with the helmets, that was, again, applying even to the advanced economies and advanced powers. Okay, so let's now start sampling from Carlin. So this first one, he's talking about a major naval battle that occurred between the British and the Germans. And so here, take it away, Mr. Carlin.
The British are chasing the Germans, and the Germans are moving away. Now, if you're the British admiral, this makes perfect sense to you. You've got the bigger ships, right? And until they start exploding around you, you have more of them. Besides that, you have a bunch of big, brand new, the newest, most awesome battleships in the world. They're Queen Elizabeth class, I've already mentioned. Warspite, Malaya, Valiant, all these famous ships that will all fight in the Second World War. They're fresh off the docks, 15-inch guns, 30,000 tons, 13 inches of armor, and Beatty's got them with him. So you darn right these Germans are going to run away. Never mind that, you know, I tried to communicate with those battleships using flags. When you talk about Murphy's Law interposing its will on this battle, part of it has to do with things that just look so silly in hindsight. You know, these ships have radio. Sometimes these admirals are not that cool about using it. Sometimes it has problems, by the way, so sometimes they're blameless. But a lot of times, these admirals are like the old guy trying to use the computer. And they're so much more comfortable with the way they were brought up and the things that they did in the maneuvers in peacetime. And one of the ways these ships communicate is by running the orders of the admiral up on a flagpole. They have all these different flags, and each one means something different. So when the admiral wants to communicate, you know, to the fleet, his orders, they run a flag up the flagpole on his ship, the flagship, and then every other ship is supposed to, as they see it, run up the same one and you get the message across. But this is a method that was used 100 years before, in Lord Nelson's time, when they're fighting Napoleon, at ranges that are exponentially shorter. Does that make sense? Exponentially shorter than the distances in this battle, without the smoke and all these other things. And in the peacetime training, it seemed to work fine. In the rigors of combat, it's not working fine. And the big battleships don't see the flag change when Beatty tells them to do things. And they're not here when this battle first happens. They've been playing catch-up the whole battle. But now, you know, they're arriving on the scene and their shells are falling sort of by the Germans. And now the British think they've got these German battlecruisers pinned down, even if, you know, you're losing a few of your battlecruisers while you chase them. But what they don't know is that those battlecruisers are leading them into the maw of the entire German Navy, which is coming up from about 40 miles away, moving towards them. What started off as the German trap flipped into the British counter trap, evolved and morphed into the encounter battle, has now, by almost improvisational luck, become a German ambush again. If successful, the German fleet could wipe out 4 or 5 battlecruisers and 4 of the newest ships in the British Navy. It would be, I'm sure Winston Churchill would say, I'm sure I could speak for him here, a catastrophe. And the Germans are on the verge of making it happen.
Okay, so there you have it. Very interesting little discussion there. And I hope you see now, if you've never heard him before, why Dan Carlin is such a joy to listen to. You see how excited he gets about it. He could be telling you how he made macaroni and cheese and, you know, I'd be like, picture moistness, just the kind that reminds you of when you were a little kid. I think back and wonder, would I have been able to boil the water like that? Yeah. Okay, there's my joke for the episode. All right, so you see there, again, something that seems ludicrous, that they have radios, they got these immensely expensive new warships that they created, and they're out, and there was this whole cat and mouse thing going on there that I just, in the interest of brevity, I couldn't quote for you just to see the context of this naval battle that's unfolding. But something as simple as, oh yeah, they were in trouble tactically because the one, you know, the flagship whoosh, put the flags up the flagpole and then the other ones couldn't see it. And they thought when they were training, they thought that would be fine. And then it doesn't work. So something little like that. Again, what I'm doing here is I'm trying to get you to see. And those of you who have read military history, you know that it's chock full of this stuff, that nothing ever goes according to plan. But I'm going to just reiterate that and for people to realize this. So there, this is a great example of how something completely stupid can go wrong, even with the British, who are supposed to be the, you know, the best naval power the world's ever seen. And they make such a boneheaded mistake in such a crucial battle. Now, you might say, okay, Bob, but I mean, come on, that's just like a one-off thing and mistakes can happen and they presumably fix that pretty soon afterward. Okay, let me give you a different example now of something that took a very long time for them to rectify. It almost cost the British the war. And this was, again, just due to complete bureaucratic stubbornness. All right, so here Carlin is going to be talking about the Germans' use of submarines to try to blockade Great Britain and to starve them into submission, just like the British were doing to them, and what exactly the Allies finally did to solve the problem.
In April 1917, the submarines sink more than 400 merchant ships. Britain's problem isn't that it doesn't have to stop all the sinking. It has to stop the rate, which is so much more than what it can rebuild. If it loses less ships than it can build a month, it's doing well. If it loses more ships than it can build a month, it's in trouble. The height of this submarine war will be from February 1917, when unrestricted warfare is declared, and the next 8 months. This is when Britain lives or dies. Those are the stakes. And Lloyd George and Churchill and all these guys go out of their way to talk about the almost alarm is the word Lloyd George uses. Lloyd George says that there are some of the most cautious people in his cabinet that are starting to muse out loud about maybe we better make peace while we still have some ships afloat. And he says the Germans were getting gleeful that at times they just had these reports coming in that made all the pro-submarine people seem, you know, to be perfectly correct. They were all of a sudden going to win the war. Churchill said we went from being, you know, the side that had time on our side and we could just wait this out and every day the Germans were losing the war a little bit more to having the tables flipped and now time was on the German side. And the British had to come up with countermeasures or lose the war fast. They not only did this, but it was the civilian leadership that pushed for the answer that turned out to make the biggest difference. This is sort of one of these early indications that something is changing in the war. For years, the military men have had almost unquestioned authority to choose whatever path for fighting the war they wanted to, no matter what happened. But now, so many people had died in so many disasters and so much of the same tactics seeming to, you know, equal the same results, except more bodies stacking higher and higher, that there was pushback now from civilian leaders. Lloyd George in Britain is one of these guys who says openly that my job is to protect the soldier in the field. And to the soldier in the field, the general's his biggest enemy sometimes. And you can hear all this talk about the stupidity of the military leaders. Even Churchill kind of goes out of his way to say that the military experts were all against the solution that ended up solving the sub problem. It was the civilian leaders, for the most part, that pushed the idea that won the day. The idea was both breathtakingly simple and incredibly complex. The idea was convoys. The grouping of ships into large formations, surrounding them with warships and escorts, and sending these large bodies of ships across at organized times and schedules. The military men often believed that this was just going to group your targets for the submarines, make it even easier to line ships up like in a shooting gallery. But when it was experimented on, again, the civilian leaders pushing to experiment with this, the results were fantastic almost right away. The U-boats that approached these kinds of formations often got sunk. The idea that it was going to be easier to spot 50 or 60 ships on the water rather than a single ship turned out to not be true. In the vast spaces of the ocean, big old convoys got swallowed up too. And as Churchill said, when these convoys made it across the water and slipped through the blockade, instead of having one ship make it through the German blockade, you had 40, 50, or 60 ships do it. By October 1917, of 99 convoys heading to Great Britain with more than 1,500 ships in them, only 10 that were still part of the convoy were sunk.
Okay, so I like that example because, again, it's classic. Anybody who studied World War I knows that history, knows that in the beginning they weren't convoying the ships. And you know, in fairness to them, Carlin hints at what the reasoning was. Obviously, the naval war planners weren't sitting around in London saying, you know, let's purposely not defend our merchant ships and let's have the Germans bring us to the brink of starvation and losing the war. Why don't we try that? Ha ha. No, that's not what's going on. They thought, understandably so, that, oh, maybe convoying would be a stupid idea, right? Because you got all these U-boats out there that are just like waiting, stalking their prey. And right now they're just picking off one or two merchant ships at a time. If you put them all together, maybe now they're sitting ducks. And so maybe now the U-boat commanders are going to get 16 kills instead of one or two for a given time period. So you can understand where they're coming from. But as Carlin explained, it just, no, that doesn't work. The ocean's so big that whether you got one or two merchant ships or 50 moving together, that's not really doing much to increase the chance of detection. And if you put them all together, then you can surround them with defensive ships to, try to repel the subs and sink the subs. Okay, so clear cut explanation of what the problem was and what the solution was. But again, look at how long that took for them to realize that. And what Carlin said, notice the verb he used, he said they experimented. And so that's exactly the kind of thing that in a decentralized war effort where you don't have a monopoly organization in charge of, quote, defense, that sort of disparity in tactics or strategy, I don't know what level you'd classify that, using convoys, it would clearly just jump out, right? Because you'd have different, at the very least, you'd have different companies. And notice, too, there's nothing about free riders or public goods or anything like that when it comes to paying a company for military defense when you're trying to escort your merchant ships through hostile waters. That's clearly a good that is private, where, you know, you're paying, you know, the destroyers or whatever, the cruisers that are escorting your ships, your merchant ships. And if you don't pay them, then they don't sail near you and you're not protected, right? Unlike having ICBMs or something defending your city from a nuclear attack, because if they sense incoming ones, they'll just launch against the enemy. And if you don't pay, but the neighbors down the street pay, you know, they can't let an incoming nuke hit your house, but not your neighbors, right? So that's the classic argument that economists use to explain why national defense has to be a public good and the government has to provide it. I'm saying those arguments don't even come close to working when it comes to naval escorts for merchant ships. There, that's clearly a private good, okay? So you got different companies. There's no reason it would just be one company having to do that is where I'm getting at. You'd clearly have competing companies, and presumably at least one of them would have tried convoying much sooner than the British did. In part, so Carlin doesn't get into it, but when I've read, I think it was James Stokesbury's World War One book, I think there he got into explaining along the lines of once the war was really underway and there had been lots of ships being sunk with the original arrangement where they weren't convoying, it became harder and harder for the military leadership to give the go-ahead to try convoying because you're afraid of being proven wrong, right? Like, it's so horrifying. And that's partly, you know, this issue of how power corrupts. And maybe what you can understand with these generals who ordered, you know, troops to go into these mud pits and they just get stuck and they drown in the mud and, you know, there's poison gas and, oh, just terrible, horrible things, that's got to mess with you, right? So I'm not saying those guys are monsters or maybe if they are, it's being in that position and giving those orders, turn them into monsters perhaps. But the point being, part of what goes on here when there's just a monopoly agency in charge and they make one decision, it's harder for them to reverse themselves. Just to change context, I think that's partly what happens when the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration, approves a drug that actually has some really dangerous side effects. It takes a long time for the FDA to reverse itself. And I think it's partly because they realize, whoa, if we reverse ourselves, that means people who died while this product was still available, it's because of our screw up, right? We should never have approved this thing in the first place. And so you're reluctant. So it's this paradoxical thing. When you make a first mistake, that's the worst the consequences are, paradoxically or perversely, it's harder to go back on it because then you're sort of admitting, yeah, all these awful things that happened, that wasn't just because, it was because I screwed up. So again, I'm pretty sure I remember reading in Stokesbury's book that part of the reason it took so long for the British to finally start convoying is that it was so horrifying to realize, what if we'd been wrong this whole time and all these people died and, you know, we came to the brink of losing the war just because we made an intellectual error. So again, if you have multiple competing companies, one of them might have been trying convoying from the beginning. And even if not, the chance of one of them at least trying to experiment just to gain market share is much greater. Or you could even have a newcomer, right? So you got a bunch of companies. Maybe it's just the established conventional wisdom and it's groupthink. Still, somebody can start a new company and say, you know, I think they're doing right. I think we should convoy, and you can start a new company. So you see how the free entry and having open competition among firms in this kind of application would have been incredibly valuable to allow the introduction of a new tactic that the other existing defenders hadn't tried yet. And then, of course, once it's working for one company, then clearly it would be adopted rapidly by everybody else once they saw with their own eyes that it was working. All right, for the next example, I want to transition away from just boneheaded mistakes to show how much modern warfare, and particularly as it played out in World War I, isn't due to the brilliant tactical maneuvers of the commanders who were trained at the best war colleges. And gee, you know, the private society, the free society wouldn't have anything analogous. So we wouldn't be able to stand up to these professional warriors. That no, what really was decisive in the long run when it came to a war of attrition like World War I was not so much who had the best sharpshooters or which commanders knew the best places to, you know, how to do an outflanking maneuver and this and that. No, it was just which side could produce more stuff. So in case you've never heard some of these statistics, it'll be interesting for you. Just listen to Carlin explain the buildup for the Battle of Verdun.
But when you hear how much planning and stockpiling and engineering feats are required to pull off something like the Battle of Verdun, you begin to see why it was so different than anything these people had ever known in the past. As we said, 100 years before, a Napoleonic battle was considered extraordinary if it went on for 3 days. Throughout most of human history, battles take hours. These battles that these Allied and Central Power planners are conducting require months of preparation. They'll go on for months, too. How do you get enough stuff there to make sure your soldiers don't starve or run out of ammunition? Well, for the Battle of Verdun, it was more than 7 weeks of actual unloading of supplies. Here's the way writer G.J. Meyer describes the planning and stockpiling before the February 1916 battle. Quote, "The Germans, meanwhile, were accomplishing prodigious feats in getting everything in place, helped by the hilly wooden countryside and the cloudy winter weather of the Verdun region. They were doing an astonishingly good job of keeping the French from learning what they intended to do, or when, or even exactly where. No fewer than 5 new railway lines were constructed across the German-held portion of the plateau immediately to the east of the Verdun Hills. In a 7-week period between late December and early February, 1,300 trains, not railway cars, but entire trains, hauled in 2.5 million shells, earth-moving equipment, construction machinery, and everything required to prepare the offensive and support 300,000 troops in winter came rolling up to Verdun. The guns were positioned in the woods and covered with camouflage, a new development in warfare made necessary by aerial reconnaissance. Underground chambers capable of holding as many as 500 men each were excavated opposite the French lines and lined with steel and concrete. In the sky above all this was the greatest concentration of aircraft yet seen on any front. 150 aircraft, a German umbrella so impenetrable that even on the rare days when visibility was good, the French pilots were unable to get a close look at what was happening. By the second week of February, everything was in place for an offensive with the potential to change the course of the war." End quote.
And then just to round out that discussion, here's one last excerpt from Carlin where he's just talking about more broadly the economic side of the war. So we'll go ahead and play this last clip.
By 1916, the economic side of this war is coming to the fore. We begin to see what war on this scale is like when it becomes part of the normal life of all of these countries. You know, this isn't a new phenomenon anymore by 1916. By the middle of 1916, we've been doing this for 2 years, and it's been sucking up more and more of the energy of these nation states that are involved in the conflict. It's very unlike the way most wars by these powers had been fought, where the civilian population might not even know a war is happening. If it was happening, they certainly weren't directly or importantly impacted. This war's different. First of all, it's life or death. The stakes are so high that everybody's involved, and the armies are requiring such immense amounts of stuff. You know, the Germans would call this Materialschlacht, a war of material, that the entire civilian population and the production capacity of all these countries gets warped trying to provide it. As historian Gwen Dyer says, quote, "It is significant that the phrase home front came into use during World War I, when the role of munitions workers and of civilian production more generally was becoming as important to victory as the soldiers in the trenches. Without a constant flow of supplies equal to the vast consumption at the front, the soldiers would soon be helpless. And since the mobilization of so huge a number of men left vast gaps in the normal workforce, France had put 20% of its entire population into uniform, Germany 18%, and the other major powers not much less, the remaining adult civilians had to be directed by government into whatever jobs were needed to keep production going. In effect, the civilian economy," he writes, "was conscripted too. The governments of Europe quickly took control over labor and raw materials, imposed rationing on all scarce goods, and created true war economies. Women flooded into factories to replace the men at the front, and most production beyond the basic needs of subsistence was diverted into the war effort." End quote. Dyer's also the one that said by this time, quote, "battles had become an industrial operation in reverse, in which the rates of destruction at the front matched the rates of production in the industries at home." End quote.
So I hope I don't have to belabor the point here, but to the extent that a modern war is determined by who can outproduce the other side, clearly the advantage lies with the free society. That's the thing at which we excel, is being able to take a given amount of resources and the current technological recipes that our citizens know and to figure out how do we best use these resources to produce the stuff we want. That's what the market economy excels at. And as we've seen, that's what was decisive in World War I. And, you know, if you say, oh, well, yeah, the Russians had a lot of men, but man, they were so poorly equipped. And well, partly that's because Russia was so backward economically. And that's not a coincidence. It's not just, oh, because their terrain or geography. No, it's just because of their social institutions. And it's not a shock that they're the ones that fell to communism. So in summary, I want to just disabuse those listeners who are anarchists in the Rothbardian tradition at heart, but they're just reluctant. They're hanging like, oh, geez, I just don't know if this would work. I want to disabuse you of that notion that modern nation states are really efficient killers. Or they're, you know, I've heard some people make the joke that, oh, yeah, the government doesn't do anything good except killing people and blowing stuff up. And we'll say, no, actually, they don't do that very well either. In the sense of, you know, trying to achieve particular objectives that a privately organized effort with market incentives would be much more efficient. So again, I want to stress, I am not saying that the free society would actually have massive armaments and a standing army and things like that. No, actually, I don't think it would. I'm just pointing out that if what your fear is you think you need to support a limited state in order to have a standing army and a nuclear arsenal and so forth, just to keep people from picking on you, I want to say no, that you don't need that. And again, the irony there is because you're afraid of being conquered by a military, by then you supporting a standing army, you would be conquered from within. That, yeah, you'd end up systematically paying money to a group of oppressors and they would be your local politicians. That's what would happen. So clearly that's not the right solution. And I'm saying the thing you're worried about, you don't need to be worried about. That especially if it's a long drawn out struggle where the victor is the one who can produce more material and who can adapt more quickly, who can realize, yeah, in modern warfare, the plan goes out the window and it says which side is more adaptable, versatile, which side can adjust to the new situation, can try new things. And then once something starts working, can rapidly communicate that success to the whole system. So the whole war effort is constantly experimenting and improving. That's exactly what a decentralized approach gives you. So it's, if you want, you can say, oh yeah, a professional standing army that's got decades of experience where, you know, where the officers grew up in the earlier wars and now, you know, they're leading the new recruits and so forth. And they've got hundreds of billions of dollars of past hardware at their disposal. And now they're going head to head against some much smaller population, free society in the Rothbardian sense. Okay, yeah, maybe you could say they get wiped out real fast. I don't think they would, but okay. But that's really all you have to say. Because if it lasts more than 6 months, then notice the free society just has this tremendous advantage. Because again, they're drawing on the creativity and insights of everyone in their population. Because anybody can start up a new company. Whereas the statist society, they have largely handed over the reins of military defense, or in this case, offense, to the generals, this small group of people who've organized their system in this very rigid hierarchy where the people on the ground don't get to communicate too many insights up the chain of command. Even here, too, I've heard people who have served in the U.S. military say that part of the U.S. military's advantage vis-a-vis other state militaries is precisely that the U.S. military is actually relatively decentralized, and they do give a lot more autonomy to lower level commanders to say, okay, you know, we recognize you, when you're on the ground out there in the field, you know, you have to respond, and, you know, here's the parameters and blah, blah, blah. So this isn't just an all or nothing thing. Different armies, even in the state mold, have different levels of autonomy versus hierarchy. But I'm just saying clearly, even if the U.S. is relatively decentralized in that respect, compared to a genuinely free society, it's not even going to be close. So in conclusion, again, the claim I'm making is that for a given population, a given amount of wealth, ability to defend themselves, right? You know, like if you just had a bunch of 8-year-olds who had sticks, well, they're going to be at a huge disadvantage. But you got people, they have firearms and so forth, they're going to be able to mount a much more resilient defense effort if they're organized according to voluntary market principles, rather than they just decide, let's have a small group of us be in charge of defense and whatever they say goes, and they can tax us and they can conscript us and they can order us around to, you know, decide how the rest of us even are going to work and what things will produce, because this group of people who represent 0.5% of the population, they're now in charge and the rest of us are just going to be sort of inert robots carrying out their instructions. I mean, what a horrible system. What an amazing way to completely stifle creativity, and then also to take your most valuable resource, namely human beings, and just march them into killing fields. I mean, it would be harder to come up with a worse way to organize your defense than what they actually did. Well, that concludes this episode of the Bob Murphy Show. Again, the links are at bobmurphyshow.com/58. Join me next time. We'll talk about something that's a little less depressing. Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time.
You've just experienced another episode of the Bob Murphy Show, the podcast promoting free markets, free minds, and grateful souls. For more information and to subscribe to this podcast, visit bobmurphyshow.com.